Hi, it's the takeaway for Thursday, July 20th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Remember January 20th? It was 6 months ago today, and that means we're now 6 months in from the inauguration of President Donald Trump. It's been a rough start for the new administration. President Trump enters the second half of his first year with an ever-deepening probe into his campaign ties to Russia. He's been unable to get Republicans to agree on health care. His travel ban was hampered and slowed by the courts. And on Wednesday, Carrier announced 300 layoffs. That's a symbolic blow, since those were jobs the president personally intervened to protect. The president's approval rating, at last look, was 37%, according to the Gallup poll. Political analysts call that underwater, and it's a bad place to be. In a few minutes, we'll talk about how Democrats are handling the Trump era. But the president's overall unpopularity does not translate with many of his fellow Republicans. They see success in the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, a rising stock market, and they applaud a rollback in regulations and a confrontation with parts of the news media.
My name's Steve. I'm from the heart of timber country, Oregon. I'm 50 years old. I'm pleased with Trump's progress, considering the obstacles the Republican Congress and a hostile media have thrown his way. Regulations are being slashed, and the stock market is soaring.
Cheryl St. Germain from Marco Island, Florida. President Trump, I'm going positive with this first 6 months. I feel he has been extremely diligent. His personality is strong and aggressive, but it seems to be damaging his image.
Kevin Loney, Manchester, New Hampshire. As you know, I'm a salesman from Manchester. I cover quite a few states, and all in all, the businesses are very happy. People are glad he's there. The mood is upbeat, and people are buying equipment. I'm not crazy about his tweets, but, the media is beating on him 24/7. This Russian thing, who was at the meeting, who wasn't, I don't care. I want, a little more action. I need more stuff done, but I continue to support him and give him some latitude.
Voices there from you, our takeaway listeners who support President Trump. We turn now to Robert Leonard. He's news director for Central Iowa radio stations KNIA and KRLS. He's from Marion County in Iowa, where 62% of voters backed President Trump in the election. That's twice as many as voted for Hillary Clinton. And he's been writing about how conservatives there see the new president. Robert Leonard, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be here.
Well, you've been talking to lots of voters in your community, writing about them, talking to them. Give me a sense of how Marion, Iowa, and its voters feel about Donald Trump and why they so overwhelmingly voted for him.
Well, of course, there's a variety of opinions amongst conservatives, but in general, they're standing strong behind President Trump. You have to remember that whenever they think about anything that President Trump does, they contrast it to what a President Hillary Clinton would have done. And they view the whatever Trump is doing, good or bad, media perceptions, public perceptions, whatever, it would be better than the disastrous presidency that Hillary Clinton would have brought.
So that's the primary metric 6 months in. When you look at things like I mentioned, 37% approval, which from a perch looks dismal, that's not quite the calculation in Marion.
No. We ran a poll at the radio station the other day last week after the Donald Trump Jr. emails came out, and we asked people, if the election were held today, would you change your vote? And almost no Republicans changed, and no Democrats did, of course. Everybody's standing strong for who they voted for.
What are some specific things that conservatives in your community and who listen to your stations say when you ask them about Trump?
Well, some people wish he wouldn't tweet so much. Some people wish that he would be more presidential. Some people, though, like him just the way he is, challenging the media. They love him as a disruptive force, and they still are talking about that they like that disruptive part of him because, in part, the establishment Republican Party tried to shove Jeb Bush down their throats, and so they're happy to have Trump around. More fundamentally, it's not so much about Trump for everybody. It's about the Republican brand and how they characterize the Democratic Party. I had somebody tell me the other day that Democrats stand against everything the middle-class, hardworking person stands for: God, country, family, and freedom. And so in an environment where that's their perceptions of Democrats, it could pretty much be anybody in there, like Grover Norquist has said, all we need is a president that can use a pen. If that's all Trump is doing, they think he's doing a great job.
Well, that's really interesting because I think you're getting at some questions of identity, Robert, and I wanted to talk to you about that. You know, there's this sense in Washington, way away in Washington, among the very political and media elite, whether in politics or covering it, that with Donald Trump, policy in a lot of ways doesn't matter. Even sometimes that the truth doesn't matter to voters. Things like 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. That's not true. I have nothing to do with Russia. That's not true. His business interests definitely did. That none of this matters because Donald Trump to many is about identity, whether it's cultural identity, whether it's sticking it to the media, sticking it to Washington. In some cases, it may have racial components. It's a mixture. Everyone's different. But one comes away with a sense that in an unprecedented way, for some, individual pieces of policy matter much less than what Donald Trump represents to them.
Yes, it matters much less than all of the what they would say trivial things about his personality, his tweets, that's just irrelevant. They're not even paying attention to them because what they want is the media to pay attention to their successes, to Trump's successes. And the media isn't portraying his successes. The Gorsuch appointment, brilliant success to conservatives. The climate change, the dismantling of the EPA, regulations going away. All of this is a major positive thing for them that Democrats, you know, they don't see it that way and they don't look at it from a rural conservative perspective.
Robert, let's talk about Russia because it is remarkable to me and I wonder if it's remarkable to you. You know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if I had told you that a president would openly acknowledge firing the FBI director because he wouldn't drop an investigation, or that the president's son acknowledged in an email that he was meeting with Russians because they were helping the campaign, I would have thought that conservatives would consider that downright traitorous. We're not in that place.
Right. And I anticipate that I would have thought the next word you would have mentioned to me would have been impeachment.
Right. And I take it that voters in Marion aren't anywhere close to that.
No, they're not. They think this is all a media witch hunt. They want him just left alone. And they don't understand. A friend said to me the other day, why is the media trying to bring down our duly elected president? I don't understand. Why are they doing that?
Robert Leonard, we're talking to a couple of people in a minute who are struggling with what Democrats should do and say in their party other than Donald Trump is bad and he drives us crazy. How do you think they could reach voters in Marion, Iowa? And if conservatives in Marion are out of reach for Democrats, what about statewide? Barack Obama won Iowa twice and Hillary Clinton didn't even come close.
There's a lot of Christian pastors that I've talked to on the left that are getting angrier and angrier. They don't see anything Christ-like in how the poor are treated, how they're denigrated. They don't see anything Christ-like in the border wall and all of the dying refugees. And that Christian left is starting to get more vocal and trying to say things. And so to me, this is a battle over the soul of Christianity and a battle over perhaps the soul of much of America.
A view from the heart of Donald Trump country in Marion, Iowa. Robert Leonard, news director for Central Iowa Radio, KNIA and KRLS. Robert Leonard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, as we've just heard, Republicans, at least in one corner of Iowa, are sticking with President Trump, even with those historically low approval ratings. Poor approval in politics doesn't mean much if the other party can't capitalize. And 6 months into the Trump administration, Americans don't think that the Democratic Party is doing much of a good job. According to an ABC News and Washington Post poll out over the weekend, only 37% of Americans say the Democratic Party stands for something. 52% say it just stands against Trump. Reporters recently asked House Democratic Caucus Chairman Joe Crowley of New York about those numbers. His answer, quote, "That message is being worked on." Joining me now to talk about that message and the Democratic Party and where it's headed are Bryce Covert. She's contributing op-ed writer at the New York Times and a contributor to The New Republic and The Nation. And also Sean McElwee, policy analyst at Demos Action. That's a progressive think tank. Bryce and Sean, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, you just heard Robert Leonard there from Iowa. His view was that a lot of Christians across Iowa, forget about Marion County, you're not going to win there. But Barack Obama won Iowa twice. He says that Christians in Iowa think Democrats have nothing to say to them and that they're not Christ-like. Bryce, what do you think about that message?
I think Democrats right now are focused a lot on opposition to Trump, and that makes sense in many ways. And it also takes some work, some coalition building. You know, Democrats don't necessarily all get on board together and decide to stand against their president. But they now need to get a little bit faster at coming up with that message that they're still working on and making sure that they have something big and bold to stand for.
Big and bold. Sean, the resist movement after the election. There were people in the streets during the travel ban. They were in the airports. They were marching in Washington. We all saw them calling senators as healthcare falters. Anti-Trump attitudes have enormous energy. And yet that poll I just cited, they're losing special elections in Georgia and Kansas and Montana, especially in Georgia, where it was a huge loss. What's going on? Why this disconnect?
I think the thing you need to start off with is what drives Republican success. And what drives Republican success is that there is a group of people who are white evangelicals. They make about a quarter of the electorate, and they show up all the time in every election. And the Democrats have a lot more trouble mobilizing their base to show up in a lot of crucial elections. In the last midterm, 17% of people 18 to 24 voted. And if that is the number in 2018, I'd be very worried for the Democratic Party.
Okay. But Bryce, look at that energy in the streets that I just described, and we've all seen it. You would see those people marching. You'd see them in airports. You'd see people going crazy about Russia and things that aren't true and Donald Trump. And you'd think, boy, the Democrats are charged up to really stick it to him in the next election, and the numbers do not show that.
I think there is a lot of energy, but I don't think you can get people to turn out in a midterm election against something if you have nothing to offer them that you're for. You know, Democrats do have a really hard time getting people out in midterms, and Republicans have a little less of a hard time just standing against things and saying, come out and vote against them. Democrats need to be for something to harness the people who are in the streets.
Let's talk about 2018, because you just described a minute ago how important it is to not be necessarily against something, but find something to be for. Now, Bryce, you say that Democrats need to have a very specific and big jobs message, a job for everyone, right?
Yeah. If you watch Trump's speeches during the campaign, one of his most consistent themes was jobs. And what he said was, I'm not going to have this complicated jobs plan or tax relief. He said, I am going to give you a job. If you lose your job, I'll give one back to you. If you want a better job, I will give you good jobs. It's something that Americans crave. And he used very simple language. Hillary Clinton offered much more complex tax relief, infrastructure investment. A jobs guarantee program or a public jobs program, which guarantees anyone who wants one voluntarily doing necessary tasks in their community, can deliver what Trump was promising in a very simplistic, straightforward way, but it actually backs it up with some policy so that it's not an empty promise.
This is a new deal. You're advocating for a return to FDR-style politics, big government works programs that guarantee jobs no matter what the economy does.
Exactly. And it helps people who don't necessarily want to change jobs as well. You know, wages have been stagnant for decades. Benefits are eroding. Very few people get, for example, paid leave, paid vacation. Jobs have deteriorated in America. This is a way to make sure that workers have more power vis-a-vis their bosses. Even if they like their job, you have more ability to say, hey, I deserve a raise. I deserve some paid leave this year. If you know that your boss can't just turn around and fire you and hire someone who's just begging for a job outside the door, it gives you a better negotiating spot.
Sean McElwee, you point to the states where Democrats have been absolutely decimated. We've talked on this show about the 1,000 total state legislative and national seats that Democrats have lost. And you say this is really a grassroots problem. We're talking about 2018, and I know you care about that, but you think that Democrats have to get to work on a deeper level.
Oh, absolutely. The House and the Senate are really going to be decided by Trump's popularity, by the state of the economy. Where we're seeing a lot of troubles in the states, we are not seeing strong challengers, for example, against Walker in Wisconsin. And we're not seeing really aggressive primaries in Ohio. And if you are not taking power at the states, you're going to have trouble over the long term, because that means that Republicans can use their state level power to suppress votes. They can use that to open the floodgates of money to politics and crush unions. And that's going to make it even harder for the Democrats to really mobilize their base over the long term.
Democrats have a traditional strong showing among young voters. They still have that, but their young voters are divided.
Absolutely. And in a lot of cases, their young voters are not showing up. And part of that is because young voters are not seeing Democrats embracing policies that would be good for them. Democrats are still wedded to the sort of 90s era, big government is over. And what we're seeing now is people actually want the government to do more in their lives. The Demos polling suggests that people are interested in the government being more aggressive in job security, in child care. And I think if Democrats really embrace that message and tell people, we will make your lives better, people will go for that.
There is a reality within the Democratic Party that we all watched over the last 18 months. Bernie Democrats versus Hillary Democrats. It's one thing to say that they need to do more to get young voters, but there was a war in this party.
Here's what I'd say. In 2016, Trump was treated as though he was not a Republican and that he was sort of allowed to run as unique. And the reality is Republicans are quite unpopular. Treat Trump like a Republican, treat the Republican Party like what it is, a plutocratic party, and run against it in that way.
Okay, but what about Bernie Democrats and Hillary Democrats, especially among young voters? You had a huge divide there. Has it been repaired? Is it being repaired? Is there a way to repair it?
I would say that the Democratic Party has really embraced sort of means testing. And the problem with the idea of sort of cutting the populace into different groups, which some of them get benefits and some of them don't, is that you lose the broad-based support that really makes these benefits sort of entrenched and very difficult to repeal. And I think that if you have universalistic programs, you will get everyone from young voters to people who tend to be middle income but still are struggling with childcare. It's not cheap.
I also think that that means you can talk about it in an easier way. If you say, we are for health care for everyone, we are for a free or affordable college education, child care that everyone can afford and access, a job for everybody, those are easy to grasp, and Democrats can actually promise policies on them. If you say, I'm going to offer some tax tweaks, voters may not know what you're talking about.
Meanwhile, Bryce, you know, the Trump effect doesn't just affect Republicans, right? I have Democratic senators all the time talk to me when I'm on the Hill. They are forced to react to the white hot media environment. They're forced to comment on the latest outrage. And senators say, don't talk about this stuff, healthcare, healthcare, healthcare. And it's really hard to do.
I think that you can do both. I mean, right now we're watching this enormous healthcare debate. Readers and voters want to hear about it. And Democrats can say both, we are against what Republicans stand for with their Affordable Care Act repeal, but we are also for this. We're not just going to say, don't support this bill. We're going to say, here's what we would do to make it better for people who are struggling on the ACA.
Sean, how much time do Democrats have to get this together? 2018 is coming.
The primaries are just starting. And I'd like to note that Democrats control their paid media. And if you look at the Ossoff campaign, they were not running against
Trump. You're talking about Georgia.
Trump. Yeah. They are not running against Trump. They are not running on health care. And that is something that they determined.
The question of whether Democrats can formulate a cohesive message in the era of Donald Trump, Sean McElwee, policy analyst at Demos Action, and Bryce Covert, contributing op-ed writer for The New York Times and others. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Now, we've been hearing from you. Where do Republicans and Democrats stand?
My name is Emily Hayes. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm a heavily involved Democrat in my community at the local level, and I'm not happy with the message that our national party is putting forward. The Democrats are currently positioning themselves as the anti-Trump party, but we need to stand for more than that. We must articulate our vision for the country in a concise and engaging way and let voters know that we stand for things and not just against them.
This is Larry from Staten Island. I know the Dems progressives have a voice, but it's unheard within the clatter of criticism for Republicans and the president. The Dem progressive message must be one of collaboration and ideas put into the public conversation. The good of the country is at stake.
Whether you're on the right or you're on the left, give us your take at 8778MyTake. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway, and you can leave a comment on our website at thetakeaway.org. The Department of Justice on Wednesday announced it was bringing back a controversial policy called civil asset forfeiture. That lets authorities seize property and cash allegedly involved in a crime, sometimes even if the owner hasn't been charged. Conservatives and liberals have both come out in opposition to civil assets forfeiture as an overreach of power. In some states, the money goes to fund law enforcement departments, setting up worries of perverse incentives. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions has made the policy part of his approach of getting tougher on crime. Nicole Austin Hillary is director and counsel of the Washington office of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, and she joins me now. Nicole, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
How does civil assets forfeiture work?
If authorities reach out to an individual or groups that they believe have committed a crime and they've arrested them, if they believe that there are assets of any kind, whether that be cash or tangible property like cars, that they believe are related to or were obtained as a result of the criminal behavior, they can seize those assets. And with respect to cash, they can then use the cash. And with respect to the assets, they can sell those assets off and use the monies gained from that and give those monies to the federal authorities or to the local agencies that obtained the arrests.
Now, part of the rationale here from a law enforcement perspective is that, you know, if you have bad people with a bunch of cash or cars, they can use that money or the cars to commit more crime while the legal process winds along.
But the problem with the way in which the federal government does this is that it violates due process laws under the Fourth Amendment. The federal government will seize assets simply based on an arrest without a criminal conviction. And we all know that within the criminal justice system that we have that exists now, that there are many people that are wrongfully arrested. There are individuals who are profiled, who are arrested. And it is problematic if we have people's assets seized who then are later never convicted, and those individuals have a tremendously difficult time trying to get those assets back. And one of the problems that we see also is this. It's not necessarily those large drug kingpins that Attorney General Sessions is talking about that we are going to ostensibly get. It is often small, low-level individuals who are committing crimes or who are ostensibly committing crimes, people who really don't have these tremendous assets, people whose families are depending on them to take care of them. So it has a negative effect, a trickle-down effect. And so that's part of the problem. And these individuals don't have an opportunity to immediately say, I'm not the right person, or I'm innocent, don't take my assets. It's the assets are taken, and then everyone looks to see, well, have we gotten the right person, or did we do this correctly?
Now, this is big money. The Department of Justice Inspector General issued a report saying forfeitures totaled $28 billion over the last decade. So this is not a small amount of money. But I mentioned that conservatives and liberals, they're libertarians, civil libertarians. A lot of people don't like civil assets forfeiture for the Fourth Amendment reasons that you mentioned. Could Congress act here and put a stop to it?
You know, Congress could act here, and so could the courts. The fact that we do have members on both sides of the aisle saying this is a problem and we need to do something about this gives me some hope that maybe this is something that they can come together around. But the courts also have an opportunity to do something about this. You know, there was a case that came up in the Supreme Court, Leonard versus Texas, which was challenging civil asset forfeiture. Unfortunately, the court did not grant certiorari, which is, you know, the terminology used when the court says, yes, we're going to accept this case and we're going to hear it. They did not in this case, but Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, in his statement, did allude to the fact that this is an issue that may be one that should be given greater attention and focus. So I think we should keep an eye out for this. It very well may be an issue that comes back up through the courts, and that might be how we eventually see relief.
Nicole Austin Hillary, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Nicole Austin Hillary is director and counsel at the Washington office of the Brennan Center for Justice. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. After an 8-month military offensive, Iraqi forces announced that they successfully recaptured Mosul from the Islamic State earlier this month. Major combat is over in Iraq's second largest city, but life is far from normal. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been displaced, infrastructure has been leveled, and despite military defeat in Mosul, ISIS and the threat of violence linger. Rukmini Kalamaki is correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. She's covering ISIS, and she's been on the ground in Mosul, where she says the fighting has split the city in two. The eastern half of Mosul was liberated months ago and is largely intact, but the old city in the west is devastated.
So when you go into the old city, the first thing that strikes you is just the stench of death. So as soon as you open your doors, that's the first thing that you notice is the smell of rotting bodies. And that's because a lot of people died in the airstrikes and in the artillery that was used to try to take back the city. Next, you notice just the sheer and utter decimation of the infrastructure of the city. Block after block after block has been reduced to rubble. You can see houses and buildings where half has been shorn off and the other half is open. A colleague of mine described it like looking into a dollhouse. But then even as you begin climbing your way through these ruins, you begin to see the signs of the Islamic State and the terror group's rule. We were able to come across a sword that was used inside of the headquarters of their religious police in Western Mosul. And the military units that we were with picked it up and said that this is one of the swords that they used for beheading prisoners. On the ground, we found pieces of paper that had the ISIS logo on them. And then throughout both Eastern and Western Mosul, anytime you see an elementary school, oftentimes elementary schools here are decorated with cartoon characters and images, you know, that children would find appealing. And you find in every single case, the terror group went around and blotted out the face of this cartoon character. So I shared an image with my Twitter followers of a painting of Donald Duck, where Donald Duck's face had been blotted out. This is in keeping with their reading of this extremely strict version of Islam, which sees the depiction of sentient life of any kind to be a violation of Islamic rules.
So, Rukmini Kalamaki, now that the residents of Mosul are looking at life without occupation from a religious force that has tactics ranging from beheading to blotting out the face of Donald Duck, what are they saying about returning home and about what life might be like over the next weeks and months?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that the Islamic State is still present. Even in Eastern Mosul, which was liberated months ago, we just finished an interview this afternoon with a young woman who I met last November. She was evacuated from there last November. And she and her family say that they have repeatedly flagged to authorities a man that they know was an Islamic State preacher who was their neighbor. And that man is still living in his house, according to them, and has not been arrested yet. So throughout this metropolis, and this was a very large city, it was the second largest city in Iraq, ISIS is still believed to be present. And as a result, people are afraid. And until the sleeper cells are dismantled, it's hard to see how normalcy will return.
A military defeat for a force like ISIS doesn't mean they go away. And I wonder if forces there that you've been talking to and traveling with are now ready to fight the next war, which may be low-level ISIS insurgency.
Well, keep in mind that ISIS's caliphate is far from over. So even though Mosul has been technically freed of ISIS control, just in Iraq, you still have the cities of Tal Afar, the city of Hawija, the deserts of Anbar, and several other smaller localities in between that remain under ISIS control. Tal Afar, according to the census that was done before ISIS's invasion in 2014, had a population of 200,000 people. That is similar to the population of Raqqa, which is the group's self-declared capital in Syria. So just in Iraq, you have another Raqqa that needs to be cleared before we can even start talking about ISIS's caliphate being over. The problem that forces here are facing is that they will declare an area cleared of ISIS rule, and then days to weeks to months later, you will see suicide explosions begin, shootouts will happen, mortar attacks. And so even when areas are cleared, very soon after, you will see the start of violence by the group again.
Does the Iraqi government have a strategy to deal with ISIS in the aftermath as they lose territory in places like Mosul?
I think the strategy right now is go, go, go. You know, so even as they've declared victory in Mosul, we're hearing that they're gearing up to start the operation in Tal Afar on the 25th, which is essentially next week. People in Mosul, myself included, reporters who are here, are a little nervous about this because that means there's going to be a large troop movement, leaving Mosul and going to another area at a point in time when, in parts of the old city that we visited, our security advisor asked us to not even get out of the car. That's how unsafe we felt.
We had your colleague Tim Arango on the show last week, and he's recently written about the overwhelming influence of Iran in Iraq now. How Shiite militias on our side against ISIS have set up supply lines and corridors to supply Shiite proxies in Lebanon and Syria, that Iran is dominating Iraq's politics, even its economy. Has the U.S. lost influence in Iraq while focusing on ISIS and terror groups?
I think the U.S. lost influence in Iraq when we began a troop drawdown several years ago. So basically, at that point, we went from being the biggest client state in Iraq to reducing ourselves to a smaller player. And now in Iraq, there's very much a jostling and a competition between groups here that are loyal to the United States and therefore to a Western-facing future, and those that are loyal to Iran.
Is there any way to know now what that means for the future and strategically in this region?
So in the short term, I think that their presence has essentially accelerated the fight against ISIS. However, the problem is that these militias, and especially the ones that have the most support from Iran, are the ones that in general have been accused of the worst abuses. Videos have surfaced of their members dragging corpses, carrying out summary executions. And what is troubling for me as somebody who studies extremism is that many of these Iranian-backed militias, in a way, ape the same language as ISIS. They talk about a holy war. They talk about what they're doing here as being a form of jihad. And so you wonder, what are we doing? What are we replacing? You know, we're pushing out ISIS, which of course everybody agrees is, you know, a catastrophic force. But what are we replacing it with?
Rukmini Kalamaki has been on the ground in Mosul and in Iraq. She's foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Rukmini, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Take care.
This week, BuzzFeed published a story full of new allegations about the R&B star R. Kelly, and the discussion you're about to hear might be inappropriate for young listeners. Several parents say the singer has been keeping their daughters in cult-like conditions where they're unable to have contact with the outside world. Women who used to live with R. Kelly corroborated the story, saying he would also film his sexual activities with them. One of the women described in the story, named Jocelyn Savage, told TMZ that she's not a hostage.
I just want everybody to know, my parents and everybody in the world, that I am totally fine. I'm happy where I'm at, and everything is okay with me.
You are not being held against your will or doing anything that you do not want to do?
Oh, no, not at all. I've never been feeling hostage or anything like that in that nature. Never.
Are you currently in Georgia, or where are you?
I'm not. I wouldn't want to speak on that.
Are you with other roommates? Are you free to go from where you are?
No, I want to speak on that as well.
Jocelyn Savage's parents say she's been brainwashed. R. Kelly has a long string of allegations of sexual abuse. He was acquitted of child pornography charges in 2008. Those charges came from a tape that allegedly showed him having sex with a 14-year-old girl. Jim DeRogatis has been writing about R. Kelly for nearly two decades. He was a reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times back in 2000 when someone sent him that tape anonymously, and he broke the story. And he also broke this latest investigation about R. Kelly. Jim is also the host of WBEZ Sound Opinions. Jim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Jim, you tell the story of Jay, that's the initial Jay, who's a woman outside of Atlanta who hasn't seen her daughter since December of last year. Except her daughter is not a missing person. This woman, Jay, has spent years now informing police and the FBI that her daughter is being held against her will by R. Kelly.
Yeah, and not only Jay, but two parents in Florida whose 18-year-old daughter, they say, is being held against her will by Kelly, allegedly as part of a cult, allegedly brainwashed. And two women who had sexual relationships similarly with Kelly confirm the way these young women are living, and a personal assistant as well. So the parents were not surprised, the Savage parents were not surprised to see their daughter Joy come out and say she is where she wants to be. She has told police that. But they also, the parents, have been talking to the FBI in hours of interviews. Of course, the FBI, Todd, will neither confirm nor deny an investigation.
Now, you mentioned you corroborated the story with three other women who have lived with R. Kelly in the past. Talk about some of the conditions in his homes that they describe that lead the parents to conclude that this is a situation where these adult women are not there of their free will.
The women are told when to bathe, when to eat, when to sleep. If they can watch TV, they must knock and ask permission before entering or leaving any room. They're told to dress in baggy jogging suits so that Kelly's male friends do not see their forms. He engages in sexual encounters that he directs and records and shows to his male friends. He confiscates their cell phones so they cannot contact friends and family, gives them new cell phones that are only to be used with him. And if they break any of these rules, they are allegedly physically and mentally abused, according to all of our sources.
Now, you've also spent a career covering R. Kelly's other behavior with women. Of course, I mentioned the tape that was sent to you in 2000 that led to the now well-known charges against R. Kelly on child pornography. He was acquitted of those charges. You also reported on his marriage to singer Aaliyah when she was 15 years old.
Yeah, let's get the timeline straight, Todd. The first investigative story that I did with the legal affairs reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times, Abdon Palish, was in 2000. It was only a year later that the videotape came to the Chicago Sun-Times. We definitively nailed at the Sun-Times the illegal marriage to Aaliyah when she was 15 years old under a falsified Chicago marriage license that said she was 18. That marriage lasted hours and the two were separated, but there had been a sexual relationship while Kelly was producing and writing Aaliyah's debut album, which he titled Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. There also have been several lawsuits filed against Kelly by underage women. One of them had a sexual relationship with him from 14 to 16, and then he ended it, and she attempted to slit her wrists and kill herself. All of that's public record. There have been additionally dozens of settlements, many of them brought by Chicago attorney Susan Loggins. Young women would come to her with allegations against Kelly and go directly to Kelly before even filing a lawsuit, and Kelly would settle those with large cash payments. Of course, he was tried and acquitted. I think what we have here is a very long and sad testament to rape culture, where the victims are not believed.
Jim, I want to talk about the latest story that you reported in BuzzFeed, because the story does represent some difficulty. These women that you're reporting on are not minors. They're adults, not like the other allegations in some cases that you're talking about. And these adults, of course, in the eyes of the law, have a right, as you point out in your story, to have whatever kinds of relationships with other adults that they want, even if they're bizarre from the outside.
Of course. You know, I think we're presenting a story that's not just about a kinky living situation, but I leave that to the readers to decide. Certainly the parents are distraught and have gone to police in three states and the FBI and lawyers and are doing everything they can to get their daughters home.
Do you feel like he's avoided accountability in the public for his behavior?
I think in the public, Todd, and I think that the journalism industry and the record industry are to blame. Too often, there are puff pieces. There was one written in the Indiana paper owned by the Chicago Tribune 2 weeks ago before he headlined Saturday at the Star Plaza in Merrillville, and it never mentions these allegations. These parents were not naive. They knew he was tried and acquitted, but all the detail of 2.5 decades of young black women left distraught and devastated in his wake are not consistently brought up. And I think journalism has done a very poor job of covering this story. And I think the fact that he remains on the top of RCA Records roster, owned by Sony Music, one of the biggest record company in the world, and they have refused to comment. The fact that he was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon singing his Christmas songs on December 23rd and getting a big old bear hug from Jimmy Fallon. I don't understand how the entertainment industry has, as the kids say, co-signed this man for so long when so many young women have been allegedly hurt very seriously by this man.
And what does R. Kelly say about the allegations in your latest story?
The first statement that we ran in the BuzzFeed story Monday was from his civil attorney in Chicago that R. Kelly is about peace and love and trying to stop the violence in Chicago. And then a second statement came out 12 hours later or so that he will forcibly fight these allegations. And I thought forcibly was a very interesting word.
Jim DeRogatis has a new story in BuzzFeed about allegations against R&B star R. Kelly. Jim DeRogatis is a reporter. He's also co-host of WBEZ's show Sound Opinions. Jim, thanks.
Much thanks, Todd.
Well, that's all for today. It's July 20th, and that's 6 months into the Trump presidency. We've been hearing from you. What's the state of your political party today?
This is Nina Hoffman calling from Charleston, South Carolina. As someone who has voted primarily for Democrats my whole life, I am at a loss to discern the party's message. Until there's a convincing party leader, I don't foresee a 2018 Democratic congressional takeover.
My name is Bonnie Bonnevere, and I live over in Squim. I've been a registered Republican for more than 30 years, but have been leaning more Democratic as of late. I'm disillusioned with both parties. They both seem far more interested in obstructing the other, and they have no willingness to work together to serve the best interests of the people they represent.
Tell us what you think. 8778 My Take is the number. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.